Welcome to Better Cast Saul, the officially unofficial podcast from Better Call Saul on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 4, Episode 10. It's the finale, titled Winner. What'd you think of this episode?
Well, it brings me no pleasure to say, but I feel like this, and if you listen to last week's podcast, you'll know that I was really hopeful that the Villa Gang, or I guess the Gooligan Brain Trust, would somehow, make some of the slow pacing and some of the weird digressions in the middle of the season worth it, and really kick over a lantern and burn the house down like they did last season. And ultimately, unfortunately, I think that this finale more or less cemented the idea that this had a couple of good nuggets and there's some things that needed to happen in this season, but ultimately I felt like it was just kind of eh. Like, the Werner stuff, I felt like, worked as far as it did, but it's not the title character having his brother burned to death. And sure. the moment that I guess the best moment for me might have been Kim standing there alone at the end. That felt very Hank on the throne of Breaking Bad scene, the WW and that poetry book. But I don't know. I feel like that. I don't know. And there's also a lot of things that I felt like it didn't make sense to me. There's a couple things where I almost laughed out loud, like Lalo jumping up into the ceiling and doing his ceiling ferret routine. And just some odd other things I'll probably talk about in the course of the episode, but I don't want to start this off with too big of a bummer because I like to find out what you thought.
Oh, I actually liked it a lot more than you did. And I don't think, it justifies the whole season because there were times when I was this isn't working for me. And I don't think it can retroactively fix that. But what I think it did do is be an awesome season finale. I think, you compare it to, it's not the main title is character burning to death. It's almost the main character burning to death. It's there is this definitive moment. And everybody was wondering, when is the moment that Jimmy turns to Saul? When is the moment that Walt turns to Scarface? We never got that in Breaking Bad. It was a gradual process, and we thought it was going to be the same here. And I think this episode is a defining moment and a turning point for that character where he is no longer Jimmy. He is Saul Goodman, both in name and in attitude. And I thought, as much as this season kind of meandered a little bit, and intentionally so, I understand that, this episode really brought it home. So I really, really enjoyed this episode. I thought, yes, I had some minor problems with the ceiling stuff, some minor problems with Gail. Why the fuck is he in this episode? In an episode that barely squeaks under the 1 hour mark without commercials.
Right.
It didn't need that extra 2 minute scene, in my opinion, but everything else was so good.
Yeah. And I guess I want to keep my comments to the meta commentary. I listened to the Insider podcast and they talked about how they really had to hack and slash at the episode to get under that hour. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that might've been a problem too. And
I mean, just the easy thing to do here is cut that Gale scene.
Yeah.
And you lose two and a half minutes.
I hadn't thought.
It serves no purpose, honestly.
I hadn't thought about that because you already had the cool Gale Baedeker a cameo earlier in the season, which I thought was good and earned and interesting. Because I felt like those edits, there's a couple of herky-jerky edits or things that are not quite right, and I felt like maybe that's one of the things that didn't sell the ceiling scenario, is that it felt like there's a couple of establishing shots and things that would have made that more believable or less what the fuck? And, I don't know. And I don't think I can be accused of being in for this season because last episode, I really, really enjoyed it. And I was yep, they're going to do it again. You're going to have Winter and it's going to be amazing. And I do broadly agree with you that they did sell the Jimmy. I think we did finally see the Jimmy, the Saul switch flip. And the fact that it was told where I think Kim was coming out of that hearing thinking the opposite, Jimmy's finally found
such a fucking, it's a moment, man.
Yeah, he finally let his guard down and was real and, something that he's processed something he's been emotionally constipated the whole season for. And then to reveal that not only I mean, the brilliant of that scene, the brilliance of that scene was that the way Jimmy talked about the marks in the room mm-hmm. is the way Kim felt.
Yeah.
Like Kim, like, well, I guess I'm a sucker because you fooled even me.
Now she's got to recontextualize her entire relationship with Jimmy. I mean, this is
right.
This is cementing the idea that I've always felt was true, that Kim is no longer in the picture, in the Breaking Bad era, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's like, oh, she can run the behind the scenes stuff. I really don't think that's even possible at this point with that moment at the end of this episode.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, let's get into the recap.
Hey, before we get into the episode, I want to talk about what's going on here at baldmove.com this week. We are excited to start our coverage of Matthew Weiner's new series, Romanovs, which is on Amazon's digital platform. It comes out this Friday, October 12th. They're going to release the first two episodes, and then they're going to release one every Friday after that, once a week. So we'll be coming back on Friday, we'll be watching on Friday, and every Monday we'll be giving it the coverage with feedback. We're going to do that on the Bald Move TV feed, since this is a limited time series. This is not going to be other multiple seasons. You can find that at the, you know, if you search for Bald Move TV, and you can send feedback to that at TV@baldmove.com. Also, if you're a club member, we are wrapping up our Empire Business season. That is a podcast series dedicated to the behind the scenes of a podcast startup such as Bald Move. We just had the State of the Empire podcast drop this week, which is does a deep dive into our financials and our future plans. And then next week we'll have the studio tour. Before we decommissioned our latest studio, we did a tour of it, and it'll be a nice counterpart to when we finally get back to studio. We'll probably have another one then. We're also in the middle of our coverage for The Deuce on HBO. That is David Simon's joint look at 70s crime and corruption in New York City revolving around the flesh trade. Having a real good time watching that. That's also on the Bald Move TV feed. Cecily and I are doing American Horror Story Season 8 Apocalypse. We do an instant take every Wednesday night after it airs. And we also have Feedback Fridays where we consider other people's thoughts. Jim and I will be checking out Bad Times at the El Royale. I want to throw in a hotel there all the time.
Hotel Royale.
That's going to be out Friday. That looks a lot of fun. That'll be in the Bald Movies feed. And then we also released into the Bald Movies feed a review of the movie Unforgiven. That was one of our last commissioned podcasts, Clint Eastwood's modern classic Western. And then next week we'll have Oliver Stone's JFK. That's what's going on at baldmove.com.
We start off with the scene that's a flashback of Chuck kind of vouching for Jimmy as he's getting his lawyer's license initially, way back when. And during the after party, Jimmy gets Chuck to have some fun singing karaoke with him. And then Chuck takes Jimmy home, and they sort of drunkenly reprise their karaoke song while they're trying to fall asleep in the same bed. It's just a nice scene between the two brothers. And it's, to my memory, the only nice scene between the two brothers. You know, we have never seen a moment in their lives where they are even remotely getting along.
Mm-hmm.
It's always couched in some, like, oh, I know Jimmy's going to fuck up again, and I'm going to have to save his ass, or look at my fuck-up brother, you know, that kind of stuff. This moment didn't feel like that, and I thought it was a much-needed thing before we kind of, I think, put that issue of Chuck to bed. I don't think we're going to be pursuing, like, oh, is Jimmy really torn up about his brother going into season 5 very much?
Yeah. So, here again... So, yeah, I agree. I think I know exactly what they're trying to do, and what they're trying to do is good and noble. But there's a lot of reasons why I don't think this worked for me, because, like, and I don't know, maybe Chuck is this schizophrenic of a dude, but I never got it that, like, you know, this is the person that pulled strings within his own law firm to keep Jimmy from being hired as an effort to thwart him from practicing the law.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we cold open to Jimmy vouching for him for his admittance to the Bar Association.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that felt very strange to me. Like, if he's a chimp with the machine gun, then what?
But he would never tell Jimmy that I'm not going to vouch for you is the thing, right? Like, Jimmy comes to him, hey, brother, vouch for me. Chuck's like, fine, I guess. Yeah. I'll have to do that because I see no other way to work around this.
No, I guess that does track, but it's just weird for a principal guy like Chuck that he couldn't find a way to, you know, yeah, you're right, because they also made it very clear that Chuck's not big for like publicly standing up to Jimmy. So,
no.
But it's weird. It also makes, I mean, you know, I guess hashtag fuck Chuck, it makes Chuck a giant hypocrite. Like, either this guy's an
sure,
existential
yeah.
threat to the law, or he's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Secondly, like, I thought that the ABBA choice for the winner takes it all was beyond bizarre. Like,
well, it's thematic, right?
But not really, because the context of that song is a person who has just been devastated in a relationship and the person has taken everything from him, which is fine knowing what we know about, I guess, Chuck and Jimmy, though Chuck burning himself, I don't think he's the winner that took it all. And Jimmy's not exactly the loser standing small. And in this stage of their career, the fact that he would choose that as his victory anthem and then
but he didn't choose it. Kim chose it.
But why would Kim do that? That's a fucking that's a song about divorce and breakup and disillusion and like it'd be
because
one thing.
He's the winner in that scenario. I mean, he just got his law license. Like that's.
But that's the thing. It's that's. But
there's a disparity here between the person who chose the song and the person who brought Chuck up on the stage and made this a brothers thing, right?
Right.
Kim was just choosing a song that the winner takes it all. Like, she probably doesn't even know the context of the song.
Kim
honestly,
doesn't know
I
the
don't.
ABBA song.
No, I fucking don't.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that it felt very forced because I guess I don't believe that Kim doesn't, you know, with her age and probably likely familiarity with Mamma Mia, the musical, whatever. Maybe I'm projecting myself onto this middle-aged blonde lawyer. But I just feel like that's like I Will Survive would be a similar type of song that would have the similar type of energy, but it's the tale of a victim that's come through it and is stronger and they've overcome. The winner takes it all is from the perspective of a person who's in this abyss and wallowing in the shame and rejection that they've felt. And for then to turn into a duet between the two brothers, I just thought was really fucked up, you know, contextually. And the fact that this was their first choice and they worked it into an Easter egg earlier into the season, which we'll talk about in the feedback, and the fact that they clearly fought for this and did a lot of negotiation. I just thought it was a really bizarre choice. And it, you know, those two things about the cold open already made me kind of like, huh, when I was going into the episode.
All right. Ernesto singing didn't do anything for you.
I did like. I mean, no,
did that help? You know?
That's a. I mean, no. There's nothing wrong with the setup. I thought Ernie was good. I just felt like they needed a better. Like of all the songs that they could have chose, in the entire catalog of popular music in the last 50 years, I just thought that was that felt like a forced choice. That the more you're familiar with the song, the less it actually makes any kind of fucking sense, especially as a duet between these two gentlemen.
Okay. I just look at karaoke scenes in general now and I go, uh-oh, they're going to try and impress me with a karaoke scene. A, you got to be a good singer. And Michael McKean, good singer.
Can hold his, yeah, that was
right.
Nice to see him belted out there.
Bob Odenkirk, maybe not quite as good of a singer. I think he's kind of known for bad singing. But you gotta high bar to hit because I've seen The Leftovers and that Homeward Bound scene.
Oh, yeah. If you, yeah.
Is one of the best karaoke scenes I've ever seen. And this, you know, not quite as good as that, but still,
understatement of the podcast. Can I, so did you buy, I mean, I also thought it was weird, the easy camaraderie they had. Like, this did not feel like the brother who's hated his brother this whole time. This felt like a brother who's kind of a stick in the mud and his younger brother knows it. And like the older brother secretly enjoys when the younger brother can pull that stick out of his ass every once in a while and let him soar a little bit. But that doesn't seem consistent with what we know of Chuck's character. The fact that he gets cajoled into staying for 10 minutes and suddenly he's on stage and suddenly he's taking Jimmy home and tucking him in, is going to cook him pancakes in the bread and they go to sleep singing the duets.
Well, if I had to guess, some of the time that they cut probably affected these scenes where, you know, they have written a much longer scene.
Uh-huh.
They've written probably a 7 to 10 minute scene mm-hmm. at the beginning of this, and then they go, oh shit, we've got an hour and 45 minute show here. We got to cut some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe they come back and try and do some shortcuts, you know, cut out chunks of it, make it still work, but not quite hang together as well as it should.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, you could just probably excise Gale from this episode.
Right.
And call it good.
You're just all for Gale erasure.
Yeah, I want Gale out of this. There's one small, nice little touch with Gale, but other than that,
right on.
Who cares? Who right cares? Let's move on to Mike sending his guys to search for Werner, and he sets about tracking him down himself by finding the location of a money wire from his wife. And that's kind of the whole scene. He sends, you know, people out on the highway. He keeps one guy there to keep everybody, all the other Germans, on lockdown. I liked throughout this entire episode seeing Mike's process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when shit hits the fan, he's in emergency mode. How does he handle it? And of course, he's cool. He's cool, right? Mike is rarely, if ever, flustered.
He's like a little Fonzie.
Yeah. So I don't know. Yes, there were extended scenes. Yes, we probably didn't need to see every single bit of this, but I enjoyed the stuff that they showed us.
Yeah, no, Mike catfishing the various people and social engineering his way to like clues and leads, like that felt right and natural. And, you know, Mike getting to flex his, you know, not just his badass muscles, but his smart calculating kind of muscles, I thought was good.
Then we go to Jimmy, who's intentionally being seen at his brother's grave on the anniversary of his death to establish that he cared about Chuck. This is all, you know, a long con here. Actually, it's a pretty damn short con. Apparently, this all takes place over a single day, which doesn't feel right to me. Because there's a lot of damn stuff that happens, but that's according to the creators of the show, so...
Right.
There's this con to make people think that Jimmy cared about his brother by him showing up in all the right places, by him, you know, paying for an event that is the sort of naming of this wing of a library. All these nice things that he's doing to honor his brother's memory on the anniversary of his death. And it pays off in the end, as
yeah,
we'll see.
I really like this because it allowed, like, it's the right play. It's Kim's play. Like, I like that Jimmy, like, throughout the episode is kind of kicking at the goads and wanting to go bigger and go splashier and, you know, do his typical Jimmy thing, which would not have worked.
Right.
Slipping Jimmy. This needed Esmeralda, or what is that? Is that her con name?
Oh,
Kim. Yeah,
I can't remember.
It needed the slipping Kimmy. Mm-hmm. It couldn't be slipping Jimmy. And you know, there's a lot of fun. I thought that Bob Odenkirk had some fun with that.
I like the Kim stuff here is interesting because I'm trying to get to the bottom of what is Kim's game with all this, because I think she has a dual purpose for this stuff. I don't think she's in it simply to get Jimmy his license back. It seems like she's almost using this as like a therapy session, because when he comes to the car and, you know, he's eating his sandwich or whatever, and he asks, how did it look?
Mm-hmm.
She goes, well, how did it feel?
Right.
Yeah. And that to me is her turning this into a mini therapy session, you know?
Or she's trying to scam him into reconciliation with his feelings about his brother. I didn't think that, but that tracks pretty clean. That, like, you know, because a big part of, like, if you don't like your current mental set, you know, really great advice is fake it till you make it. If you don't feel confident, if you don't feel strong, then act like you do, and that pattern of behavior will essentially start to mold and start forming their new neural connection. So I can see her staging it, like, okay, here's the grave, look at it, and like, here's your brother's body down there, and here's people that are going to come up and wish him well, look how many people, look at this law library and how many people came to it, and what it meant, like, that performing it would actually be like a rehearsal for the real thing. And that's what is so terrible about the ending, is that, like, now she thought she had successfully conned him, and then she didn't. Huh.
She definitely didn't. She's trying to sneak therapy in there.
Yeah, no, I like that. That's a good take.
All right, then we move to Lalo staking out the chicken farm, and he spots Gus himself leaving the grounds. Anything you want to say about this scene?
It's
pretty short.
Yeah, I thought it was because, you know, we talked about what they're going to do about the chicken ranch, and it turns out that they just completely recreated digitally.
Yeah, they did what they call a matte painting, which I think it's a weird term for something that is digitally done, but I suppose you paint digitally.
Right. And I made that joke last week about, like, it might just be a, like, you know, the thing era matte style painting.
And essentially Ralph McQuarrie in there. And
it's a three-dimensional one that they can rotate because, like, you know, they actually, I guess, they got a satellite map of the old chicken farm and they figured out where in the hills the Lalo would be. And then they rotated the, because I guess that they built this digital facade last season for a brief sequence at it that I'd forgotten about. But they were able to rotate it, relight it, and make it look very convincing. There's a lot of digital trickery. Like this scene where he sees this frantic activity and like Gus and his henchmen rushing out to go, you know, mix it up. That wasn't actually Giancarlo Esposito because he had broken his leg in a skiing accident or something like that. Yeah. So they were having to digitally replace and alter a lot of stuff. And I thought it looked great. In fact, I thought when I was watching this, like they just found some other shipping location, just shot it. Right. It didn't even occur to me that was entirely fake.
Okay, then we move back to Mike and he goes to the place where Werner's money was wired. And he convinces the clerk to let him see their security cam footage by telling him that Werner has dementia and diabetes, which the double D's, as I like to call it, and he's worried about him. So Gus shows up, and he tells Mike that the men are on the way to the airport to intercept Werner's wife. Mike asks for a little latitude to find Werner and get him back on the project, and Gus agrees. And then afterward, Mike figures out Werner must have gone to a hot springs in the area. Oh, and Lalo spies Mike in this scene, and he begins tailing him.
Do you really think that Mike thought it was a possibility that they'd be able to get Werner back into the project? Was that, you know?
I do think Mike thought that, but I don't know that that was ever a possibility.
It doesn't seem like, you know, one of the things about making Gus a bit of a psychopath early this season is that it really recontextualizes what he would be willing to consider. Like, I used to think that he was, you know, he was like a violence as a last resort kind of guy.
Right.
But now I think he's just like, he's just a very smart criminal and knows that body counts are what draw attention. So he has no compunctions about killing or even making it a last resort, but he wants to make damn sure that he could get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't indiscriminately kill, but it's not because he's got any scruples or he's a basically decent guy who's just trying to make his way in the world of meth. It's he doesn't think he can get away with it. So I don't know. And I also think, I also wonder if, I don't know if we'll ever find out, but I also question whether Mike saved Marguerite for the same reason. Because
he thinks she's going to get the chop.
I mean, it seems like it would make things a lot tidier that, you know, these two German couple are on a vacation and they had an accident and they went missing or they went hiking up in the hills and they were never seen again versus having an international inquiry into something that gets sound like Madrigal Electromotive would get involved. And, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the bummer here is we know that nothing comes of it.
Right.
Like, the super lab doesn't get discovered that way.
Right.
The operation doesn't get shut down. Gus isn't brought to justice. None of that.
Right.
So
it doesn't really matter. Yeah. But, like, it's clear, like, you know, Gus is not going to be persuaded by, well, it's the right thing to do. Or the only way you can persuade him is, like, well, this is the way that's smarter and it's not going to get you caught. I think Mike tried to play that card.
Yeah, the, you know, get him back on track and get this project done is a pretty good argument because the amount of legwork and the amount of time and money that he's going to have to spend to get somebody, some other crew in here to finish this job is probably significant.
This does answer, because you had the question, like, what the fuck?
Dude, I was totally wrong on my read of Werner. in this episode. Is that where you're going?
No, but I'm glad you said, because, like, I mean, we can talk about that now. We can talk about it later. I actually think that you kind of poisoned my well, because I thought that was such a smart take. The fact that, like, the Marguerite situation was just him realizing the danger he was in. Like, I still think now
I thought
that,
so too.
Now that I know it, he was just missing his wife, like,
it's... It makes him seem foolish and reckless and naive.
Yes. And also the scene of him going down that explosives and having the nervous breakdown doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, really? I mean, he's missing his wife so much that, like, the, like, what?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what they're going for. I get it. Like, Werner,
right.
They want to make him kind of naive here about this criminal underworld that he's working with.
Here's the thing. Werner's a very smart guy.
He is, yeah.
And I guess I took it for granted that all these people would have some experience with the criminal underworld, that you wouldn't just snatch a well-regarded structural engineer from Munich and fucking put a... Like, because, like, this guy had... Went out in the mountains, had a bag put over his head, mm-hmm. and driven in the back of a van for 5-6 hours, or whatever it is, and then taken a secret location, and I mean, you're right. It makes him look almost unconscionably stupid,
mm-hmm.
and foolish, because, like, him trying to escape and being on the run, that I think would have been a much better place to take the story. And fuck you for putting my head to that direction, because the thing that actually happened seemed like it was a bit of a womp womp, you know?
Yeah,
and it wasn't like two kind of equals, like, you know, two fairly smart guys, like, being, you know, pitting their wits against. It was just some doofus engineer against Mike, and Mike, of course, is going to track him down. And
of course, yeah.
And then they, like, the way they scene at the end of the pool, or you know, when Mike finally finds him, he's got the stupid lime green Crocs or whatever they are. It's like they turned Werner into a cartoon character by the end, which
they do. I will, and I hate that I do this constantly, but I will advocate for the devil here. And I will say that I think what they were trying to do with Werner is show a man who thinks that he has gained trust,
mm-hmm.
who has in fact not gained trust. And he thinks he has a friend in Mike, right? And that Mike can make a decision, can make a call for him, and can vouch for him, much like, you know, Chuck would vouch for Jimmy. At the beginning of this episode, I think that's the mistake that Werner has made, is that he thinks Mike is on his side and has some say over this,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a bond there. And I know in previous episodes you weren't really feeling that, which I guess that makes perfect sense, because Mike doesn't want to put himself in that position. Mike can't put himself in the position of decision maker here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where they were going with it.
I did. I mean, I do want to correct you a little bit. I did, by the last episode, say that they'd done enough to make me think that, you know, Mike killing Werner is going to be, you know, at least as sad as someone forcing to kill their puppy.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, like, it's going to be a regrettable situation all around. But yeah, I just felt like you just made a little tactical misstep of. And this is something we've talked about them doing before. Instead of elevating a character to make them the equal of the protagonists, they just dumbed a person down. And they do that a lot with Jimmy, where, like, Jimmy, to target a Jimmy scam is frequently a fucking moron, or, like, an easily manipulated fool. That's very rarely that he gets get called out by. You know, like, would this scam work on a reasonably cautious or self-aware person? And a lot of the times the answer is no. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, boy, I don't know. Again, maybe another week in the writer's room where they're like, hey, Werner's a smart guy. He just did this crazy ass, laser pointer scenario to get away. He really thought he could just walk off the job for four days and come right back with no repercussions. I just felt like they didn't sell that part of the story. And I felt like they're going halfway down the other, like the story that you were wanting them to tell, which is Werner trying to escape because he's realized he's working for Mad Men.
Right. That was 100% wrong, though.
He
definitely didn't. I want to talk one more specific about this scene when Mike goes behind the counter and he is looking at the security footage. The clerk doesn't bat an eye, and he definitely absolutely should. And this maybe is a case of making a character kind of stupid.
Mm-hmm.
This clerk guy is a little dumb, but but not to a huge extent. But Mike, when he takes over the controls and expertly navigates the security footage, as if he's done this a million times before, that should set off alarm bells in the clerk's head.
Yeah.
And he doesn't bat an eye, and I love that moment.
Right. Yeah, because I did think the clerk, like, that was a very compelling story. And then it's a great choice by Mike, because it would explain the fact that Werner probably was acting agitated and nervous and unfamiliar with the area. And it's like the perfect, I thought that actually Mike was going to do a little bit of German to just do a few idioms here and there to sell the fact that he's this guy's brother.
Sure.
For what it was pretty good.
All right. We go to the library dedication event, where Jimmy's spreading the word amongst the lawyers that he was the one who anonymously paid for it to honor Chuck, and the plan seems to be to get word back to the panel of judges in charge of his appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they keep tipping their hand here, letting us know that these are scams. None of what we're seeing is meant to convey any emotion on Jimmy's part. It's all simply part of the plan to get his license back.
But to your theory, like, it also plays that, like, you know, look at this thing where people are, you know, like, he says that every lawyer from the Southwest is here to pay respect mm-hmm. for this great man, and they want to, you know, like, another. I feel like Kim, if I'm going with your theory, she's engineering another situation like after the funeral, where we had like all these lawyers come up and express condolences to Jimmy, but he just wasn't in an emotional place to hear it. You know, like, I think you can forgive Kim for thinking, well, 10 months down the line, you know, after all he's been through, maybe this stuff is going to penetrate and find the chink in his emotional armor and his anger and bitterness. But Not at all, Kim.
Okay, Mike figures out which hot spring Werner is at, and he notices Lalo on his tail. So he pulls into a parking lot, and once Lalo's inside, he jams the exit gate behind him, slipping Lalo in the process.
I wonder how many copycat gummings are going to happen in the airports and
hopefully and, zero. And, come on, people.
Yeah, I mean, I know.
It's funny to
numbers.
Watch on TV. You're an asshole if you do it in real life.
I just keep thinking of how many fuckers threw pizzas on that poor couple in New Mexico's house because the Walter White house. Mm-hmm. To the extent that they had to get security cameras and start being kind of dicks to the fans about it, like, So, yeah.
No, people were the worst.
But no, it was good because I the whole time I'm wondering, like, what? Like, this was a really good because I'm like, okay, Mike's chewing gum in response to this threat. What the fuck? How is this possibly going to?
Yeah.
How is this possibly going to work? And then when I started thinking, he's gonna gum up the machine. I'm like, well, Lalo will just bust through the arm.
Yeah.
It required him to. Like pull out in front of a guy. That was another clever scheme.
Yeah, well constructed, well thought through,
very and very resourceful. And I completely bought it. So mm-hmm. so bravo to the team for that.
Yeah, I kept thinking this whole time, as soon as Lalo begins tailing Mike, I'm like, Lalo is not good enough to tail Mike. Nobody's good enough to tail Mike. I wouldn't even buy it if Victor was trying to tail Mike.
Right.
And so the fact that he immediately hatches this plan and skips him on him, I really enjoyed. And also the fact that he uses a parking garage or mm-hmm. a parking lot to do it.
Which,
Mike has so much experience with parking lots.
Yeah, yeah. It goes into his rich parking lot attendant background. He knows exactly the number of sticks of gum that'll uh-huh. take to jam a machine.
For sure.
It's
just a nice little touch, you know?
I did think that, honestly, Lalo pushing the guy out in the traffic, I thought was kind of stupid.
Well, that's the Salamanca in him. I look at that and I say,
okay,
maybe he's more of a Salamanca than I thought.
Yeah.
He's reckless. He's violent. He's angry, hot-tempered.
So when I say I thought it was stupid, you're right. It could be a valid character moment. And they are trying to tell us that, oh, yeah, you thought he was a little bit more genteel and smooth. But when the chips hit when the chips are down and the shit hits the fan, or as I like to call it, when the chips hit the fan, apparently, he
crumbs everywhere.
Yeah, he goes Tuco. which is like YOLO, only not as fun. And but it's like, yeah, that's a massively stupid thing to do. Like, shut this guy out in traffic.
Absolutely.
And like, you know, like, how many people are going to see you? They're going to get the license plate. They're going to, like, you're, I think, a foreign national and probably got a criminal record as long as your forearm. Mm-hmm. Like, what's he doing? But yeah, maybe you're trying to tell us that he is, that's a kooky Salamanca. But I don't buy it. Because no fucking Salamanca in the world would spend hours up in the hills with glass, field glasses and a notepad patiently writing down license plates to get the business DNA and fingerprints on Gus Fring's Enterprise. They just mm-hmm. wouldn't. So,
I mean, he's a different type of Salamanca, but he's still got the Salamanca in him.
Because here's the thing. I almost feel like... If they're going to shove him out in traffic, then they should have done something. Like, there should have been a stage two of like Mike trying to get away, but it just fizzled. So like, why have your antagonist do something that any person watching the show could see is dumb and foolhardy from a person in his perspective? If you're not going to have it pay off,
like, yeah, it does seem like that's the moment to say, well, I got bested this time. I lost the battle, but I'm going to win the war. Right.
Right.
Like, okay, he ditched me. I'll just wait. I'll play it cool.
But, or maybe even have him like slowly smile to appreciate that this guy is a careful, worthy adversary.
Yeah.
And
he knows that he'll have to step up his game if he wants to catch him.
Right.
Yeah, maybe. They didn't go that way though.
Mm-hmm.
So we go to a meeting of the scholarship board, including Howard and Jimmy, and they're interviewing candidates. This is the scholarship that I guess was set up in with Chuck's money after he died.
And Jimmy is supposed to be on the board of it anyway, so...
So Jimmy thinks that they should give one of the underprivileged kids a chance at the scholarship, but the rest of them vote against it. Afterward, Jimmy catches this girl who he wanted to get the scholarship in the parking lot and tells her that she needs to do whatever it takes to win, which includes cutting corners, and make everyone who holds her back suffer because, in a callback to the beginning of the episode, winner takes it all. And when he tries to leave the office, his car won't start, and he breaks down crying. This is a complex scene.
Yes.
Emotionally. And I really like it.
I love the picture of Chuck that they've commissioned and painted and now hangs in the conference room. Do you think Michael McKean, they gave that to Michael McKean?
I hope so. Because I would love nothing more than to have a professionally, like an oil-painted portrait of myself up above a fireplace somewhere. That'd be amazing.
I think we can make that happen, Jim.
We probably could. I don't want to make it happen, though. There's something gross. There's something really gross about it.
You just want someone to recognize your greatness enough that they just automatically
to come to me and say, I'd like to paint your portrait.
I need you to sit for a painting. Mm-hmm. I thought that was great, that looming over the whole proceeds. And I also like how, I mean, one of the smart visual pieces of storytelling is how they kept cutting off the students, as they're asking questions. And I think that reinforces the point that they already knew who they're going to select, you know, just based on their records.
Their responses don't matter.
Yeah.
So don't
show them. Like this interview does this interview is a mere formality. Mm-hmm. And did you think there's anything significant about Christy, the girl who had the shoplifting problem? Her last name is Esposito,
which is Giancarlo's last name.
Yeah, probably a nod to Giancarlo.
Could be. Yeah,
I thought that, like, in fact, I thought the way Jimmy had this really impassioned and, I think, persuasive plea to reconsider, I thought this was going to be part of the scam. Mm-hmm. But instead, it was just a piece of his personality. He's trying to give this girl the talk that I guess he wishes he'd gotten, or he, you know, like looking back at his life, what he'd sum up his work ethos. But
the way they
played it was very weird. And like, I imagine like this grown man accosting this girl and her ranging her about like, cut every corner, fuck every person that gets in your way.
Yeah.
You know, Dracarys, blood and fire. Like it's like, and she kind of played it that way. Like, okay, mister, I got to go to my bus.
Right.
But then, Jimmy gets out there and he's in his shitty car and it won't start and he breaks down and sobs.
Yeah.
When I saw that, I thought that Jimmy was having like a real breakthrough. Like, he was, like, the anger and the futility and, like, the resentment towards his brother. Like, it was finally starting to boil over, and he was feeling some genuine feelings.
I think he is. He just comes away from it with a different view than I guess you wanted him to.
Yeah, but what then do you think he... What was he feeling in that car?
I think he was feeling the crushing weight of losing the trust, you know, that's what this episode and this entire relationship, honestly, between Jimmy and Chuck seems to be about, is losing the trust. And no matter what you say, no matter what you do, as Mike says at the end to Werner, there's nothing that can fix that. And I think that's a shitty thing, like in general, to not allow somebody to earn back trust. But clearly in the relationship between Chuck and Jimmy, that is what Chuck held over Jimmy's head the whole time. It was, you know, Jimmy has fucked up, and that's who he is. You know, that like, this girl has made a mistake. She is shoplifted and she got caught doing it. The last 2 years where she's been on the straight and narrow and had great grades, none of that matters because of the one mistake that she made earlier on. And I feel like Jimmy understands that on a deep level. Like, he has been held back his entire life and never taken seriously because of one mistake that he's made, right?
Yeah, that's his lived experiences.
Right, and so when he breaks down in his car, I feel like that's him going, this is the rest of my life. This is who I am. I'm defined by the mistakes I've made in the past, and I will never get another chance. No one will ever give me that. So I can see why he, you know, is deeply saddened by that.
Right.
And why, I guess, it viewed through that lens, you don't expect him to come out the other side going, oh, maybe I, you know, need to grieve over my brother and be a better person. He very much says, fuck you, I'm going to the 50th floor. And you're going to hate me on the way while I do it.
Right.
So.
But I'm going to laugh all the way to the bank.
Yeah. Yeah. All the way to Nebraska. So that's how I read that scene. And I thought it was powerful. I mean, Bob Odenkirk in that car at the end is astonishing. Like, I don't know. Between this and the final scene in the episode, I was blown away by Bob Odenkirk.
He's really good.
Yeah. So let's go to Lalo going to the money store and asking to see the footage. But this clerk, this time around, Lalo doesn't quite sell it the way that Mike did, and he's suspicious. So Lalo climbs through the ceiling to get behind the glass and forcibly views the footage. And then he sees Mike take the brochures for the hot springs on the tape, and he gets an idea, which we don't see play out until next time.
I thought, and I heard on The Insider that this was basically, you know, something that's happened, like there's CCTV footage something like this, where you got this armored vestibule and a person going and going up through the ceiling. I don't know. Like,
I don't think it would happen nowadays. I think they probably build to the ceiling.
Oh yeah, but I'm just saying, like, back then, I felt that it was pretty unpersuasive the way it was filmed. Like, this guy turns away for 5 seconds, turns back, he's gone, and then suddenly the guy just bursts through the ceiling, like General Kenobi, hello there. And
right.
I just thought it was silly. I thought it was silly. Like, I think there maybe could have been a way where, I don't know how they do it, but like, it might have been more menacing to like for the guy to be like, no, and like, you know, and I'm, there's bulletproof glass here, and if you don't leave, I'm gonna have to call the police. And like, for the like surprises with Lalo's athleticism, because I guess they hired a guy that can do parkour and stuff, like,
yeah,
to see this guy scramble up the ceiling, and like, it's a race between this guy who's nervously trying to pick up the phone and call the cops before Lalo gets to him, and he just is too late. But the way they played it, like, he's almost Batman, I thought was just honestly ridiculous. And I was having trouble fully connecting to the material. And I felt like every 50 minutes something like this would come along and just be like, that's a bridge. That's a little bit of a bridge too far.
The only problem I had with this series of events is him getting into the ceiling. Him dropping down through the ceiling, I think, is entirely plausible.
Okay, sure.
But getting up into that drop ceiling is, I think, not just a difficult thing to do, but maybe an impossible thing to do. They talked about how, you know, even the parkour stunt guy that they had dropped through the ceiling got a fucking ladder and went up in the ceiling, right? He didn't right. grip the fucking rails of the drop ceiling and hoist himself up.
Yeah.
Because you know what? You probably can't do that.
Yeah. And that's, I just felt, and that's the other reason I felt like they shot it the way they did is because, like, you know, Jesse getting out of the neo-Nazi pin was plausible and could be done, and someone did it, you know? Uh-huh. But whereas, like, I agree with the way they set and the way they established that, like, I didn't think it was plausible that he could jump up there, especially in the time allotted.
Right. With no noise whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, I just felt like maybe they need... Because the thing is like, I saw some defenses of... Because I think the whole reason for the ceiling is because you're supposed to have this armored facility. Mm-hmm. I guess my first thought is not every money transfer place I've been to has this kind of protection.
That's true. Yeah.
Like, shit, you can wire money from a gas station and not all the gas. Like, there are some gas stations that are armored, but, like, not all of them. And, like, maybe you just stage it in a place where he can just threaten the guy with a gun.
Right.
And then it's like, well, what if he gets, he's on camera? Well, he could just delete the security footage. I felt like it was a big set piece that wasn't really much of a set piece because it all happens off camera, and the stuff we saw felt, like I said, silly.
Yeah, when he drops down, initially I thought, man, that looks kind of bad and weird.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that an actual stunt guy dropped down through that ceiling and that's just how it looked,
mm-hmm.
kind of like puts me at ease on that stuff. I'm like, right. Okay, well... I guess if they just filmed the guy actually doing this, I can't complain too much about what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's more of like a guy dropping through the ceiling looks like a guy dropping through the ceiling. It's everything they didn't show.
Yeah.
And I felt also that that scene felt like it was cut within an inch of its life.
Uh-huh.
Like they really took, like they're talking about taking individual frames. I felt like the editing there felt too tight. And then without the establishing shots and shots that actually happened, it wasn't plausible to me.
I think the thing that they're doing in this scene that I really liked, though, is further establishing just how different Mike's methods and Lalo's methods are, and also how much better Mike is at this, because none of, you know, obviously tailing, like, Mike is so much better at tailing people.
You know, Lalo's sloppy as hell. Like,
fucking sloppy.
Like Mike did, okay, I want to make a sudden turn and put a car behind him, and Lalo, like, swerves into the, and across the double yellow to make sure he hasn't lost. It's like, he's a terrible, terrible tail.
Terrible. And then he gets to this place where Mike has convinced this clerk thoroughly that he needs to find his brother-in-law, and, you know, he allows him to watch the footage, unhampered, and then Lalo comes in, tries to do the same thing, and gets stonewalled, you know, has to resort to the Salamanca way.
Right.
Has to go in there and kill the guy to get the security footage. So I think they're really setting up just the difference between Mike's methods and Lalo's. Works for me. So then we go to Lalo tricking Werner into revealing some information about what he's doing. This is the phone call scene at the hot springs. And then Mike shows up, and he puts a stop to it. I couldn't have had a more ominous scene for Werner, because this is the second time he's fucked up in the exact same way, slipping information to somebody who doesn't need it and shouldn't have it.
Yeah, I was like the whole time I'm like, because I wasn't sure if Mike would. I was pretty sure, but I was trying to do the whole thing of the first time I was watching this, like, huh, I wonder if Mike's going to get there. And as he kind of starts saying, like, more and more deconstruction details, like, I guess that's not damning. And I walked away of, like, I don't think he told Lalo enough to, like, compromise the project.
Yeah.
But, I mean, now Lalo knows that there's some big secret construction project.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, I don't know, it's something that I think they're going to have to address next season, because my first question is, how is the cartel so unaware of Gus doing the Super Lab stuff? Like, I know, maybe it's the fact that there's years and years that elapse until they start, like, you know, ramping up production. So they had forgotten about it. But, like, I just feel like the Lalo, if he, you know, calls the headquarters and says, yeah, Gus Fring is up to no good and he's doing some kind of big construction project and he ends up dead in the desert next season, then why wouldn't that provoke all-out war between the cartel and Gus?
Could it be, maybe, could he pass it off as another restaurant?
I mean, It's, I mean, yeah, that's the way to go, right? If you just, but I mean, here's the thing in the context of, if Lalo didn't know that Gus was freaking the fuck out and, like, this is an all-hands-on-deck thing and they're, like, I think you could be forgiven for thinking that. But, mm-hmm. you know, Lalo knows that this is not, like, a, oh, God, we ran over budget on pouring a foundation for a fucking chicken joint.
Yeah.
Also, it's a matter of public record whether Gus is building a chicken joint right now or not. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, like, I two seasons ago, not a doubt in my mind would be that the Villa Gang or the Gooligans would come up with a way to square, you know, to round these square corners and to make everything satisfying. I think my faith in them has taken a bit of a hit because there's a lot of kind of, like, rushed development of plot lines and set pieces and you know, maybe not as much care to the history of the characters and their motivations as I would like to see. Or maybe I'm just, again, it's always possible that I'm just sour grapes because things are different than what I thought they'd be.
Yeah, I mean, I got I fucking misread Werner
sure.
big time. So, you know, there's always that level of disappointment where you're like,
but it's always,
I think I got a beat on the character.
Right.
Oh, I actually didn't.
Right.
And if you can look back and say, okay, well, what is the story they're trying to tell here?
Right.
And does that line up with consistently with the things they've shown us? And if that's the case, then I'm fine with it. But
that's why I have the burn, because, like, I, you know, I didn't have any real dog in, I mean, obviously it's your theory, and, like, I felt like if your theory was wrong, I wouldn't care. Probably it'd be amusing, and I'd tease you about it. But
I mean, it's
when
wrong.
When your theory's wrong much. And what actually happened I felt was less satisfying and made less sense, that's where...
Call me Pete. Call me Pete. We'll get this show back on track.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. All right, we move on to Kim planning Jimmy's speech to his reinstatement panel. But Jimmy has a better idea than to go through all the trouble of writing this speech. He's just going to read Chuck's letter to the panel. So the letter returns. We were wondering, like, oh, really? That's all? The next episode, they're going to show us the letter, and that's mm-hmm. going to be the end of it? Well, mm-hmm. it comes back.
And at this point, I thought, this is really smart, because yeah. Jimmy's right. They're, you know, the whole point of the Miss Esposito scene was that they're never going to be able to overlook this, but they might, with this massive campaign that they've engineered, they might believe the dead brother's words.
Right.
And it's so wild that I do feel like that's like, so they had an expectation. They subverted it with him just, like, using the letter, and then they subverted it again at the final, and that's one that I thought yeah. actually really worked well. Like, if this finale was just the Jimmy and Kim stuff, I think I would have liked it a lot more. I still don't mm-hmm. think it would have been as impressive and as a jaw drop as some of the previous season finales, especially last season.
Yeah, I mean, Lantern, come on.
But... it would have, you know, it would have been, but with all the Mike's kind of silliness and inconsistencies, it's, I don't know, I just felt like this finale feels like the season itself. It was overly long, kind of discombobulated, and ultimately you felt like they could have gotten to from point A to point B a lot faster and not sacrifice any quality. In fact, maybe increase the quality, but I don't know what...
I mean, my general feeling, and I guess we'll talk more about it in the wrap-up, though,
yeah.
Is just that they went for something in this season that is very, very hard to make interesting and very hard to make the audience understand. And I think they mostly pulled it off, but in places they couldn't do enough with what they had
yeah.
to really make it work.
Yeah.
Or to make it work as well as previous seasons, because I think... overall, it kind of worked. Like, I got what they were going for. It just wasn't as engaging as previous seasons, where there felt like there were real, actual stakes here between yeah. the brothers.
Yeah, and I don't have a good handle on whether our opinion is mainstream or not, because, like, I think our mailbag was a lot more mixed this week, but
yeah.
I feel like we also, in our bitching and moaning... or at least my bitching and moaning in the middle of this season, we might have turned some fans off. So what we have left is maybe over representative of people who are kind of like, eh. But because it's sure. like all that, it seemed like the majority of the top voted comments on like the post threads of like the Better Call Saul subreddit was very like, not just this is a good season, but like this is the best season yet. And, you know, of course, everyone said that on the official podcast. And. It'd be strange to be like, you know, kind of shit the bed this season.
And, right.
It's a half as good as last season. Oh, well, we'll try again next year.
Nah,
but
I blame you, Chris. We needed Kelly in here to really fix things up.
I just don't. Yeah, I don't know what to think about it. I just know that this is my honest opinion. And it's certainly it's certainly not clickbait, because if anything, the way these fandoms work is if you're consistently kind of critical or lukewarm, it tends to be traffic. Blah. So
right. So Mike takes Werner out to the desert and then calls Gus. He tells Gus that Werner was talking with a guy on the phone, and Gus is adamant that he must die because he's divulged some information. Mike decides he's going to do it himself, I guess out of some act of kindness to Werner. After Werner calls his wife and convinces her to go back home, Mike puts a bullet in him.
Yeah, I mean, I really like Mike's goddamn it, like, you know, when he realizes, mm-hmm. because the thing is it's a kindness to Werner because Gus is just going to liquidate him and his old lady.
Yeah.
If he can get Werner to kind of, like, you know, agree to play along with this, he might be able to spare one of them. Might be able to spare Marguerite, but mm-hmm. It's just interesting. And I also thought, I mean, we talked about how it would be a fundamental betrayal of Mike's character if Gus just coldly has him liquidate the entire team at the end of the season after they did a successful job. Is it still a bit of a problem that Mike is working for Gus and he's, I don't know, like, how does Mike score this morality? Because
I mean, he gave the guy fair warning.
He gave the guy fair warning, and the guy should have known with the, but that's the thing, like, if Werner was the guy that they hired, I don't think he would have done this. And the guy that would do this would not have gotten hired. It's like a weird, they want me to believe that Werner is the guy who can, with, you know, go into the situation where it's clear that something illegal is happening and you're kind of in mortal danger, and make this big of a fuck up over, like, I mean, if he had a daughter dying of cancer in Germany, like, but just you haven't seen your wife in 10 months and you miss her, and you're going to, like, after Mike has made it very clear that this is a danger, like, if in case you missed the black bag treatment you got on the interview, this is a dangerous person, is not to be fucked with, and he's just going to go off and you know, blow through all this security, like,
he's a fool but I think that plays into why I can believe that Mike could do this and then continue to work for Gus, because Werner is a fool.
Right.
You know, Werner getting killed here is no one but Werner's fault, in my opinion.
Yeah.
He should have understood the situation he was in and known that he can't just leave. And he knows he was doing something fucking wrong, right? It's not like he walked out the back door and said, see you guys, waved to the cameras and left. He fucking sabotaged his way out of that building.
Yes, he did.
What do you think those cameras are for? To watch you walk away? No.
Right.
They're there to keep you there, you fucker.
Right.
So, totally his fault, and I think Mike, in my opinion, I think a guy like Mike could take that blame and put it where it belongs and say, this is not Gus doing a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. This is Gus doing the thing that needs to be done, and a thing that Werner should have known would happen if he made the mistakes he made.
Yeah, because, like, I think if Mike balks at this, then Gus is going to have to start having second thoughts about him, whereas... You know, Mike offering to make this right and take care of it himself, I think, has the opposite effect, where Gus is like, because I think Gus is starting to worry that he's emotionally compromised.
Yeah.
He already is like, are you sure about this guy? He really fucked up our operational security, and Mike vouched for him, and then he goes, you know, rabbit on him. And, like, yeah, I guess I buy that Mike still sees himself as the good criminal, because he held up, he did everything he could to try to protect this guy and try to get him from, you know, getting himself killed, and Werner just wouldn't go along with it.
Yeah, the guy.
But the thing is that I just still think that makes Werner a fundamentally sillier character, and they, you know, they treat him like fucking Steven Root from Office Space by the end of this episode. And then it's just, I don't know, there's that's also a tonal shift. It's a shift in the character's, like, level of seriousness, and then they make him into a clown, and then they kill him. A lot of emotional whiplash for me.
Okay. I did feel like there was a little bit of a mistake that Mike made here, which was essentially the mistake that Victor makes in Breaking Bad when he gives Walt the phone to make the phone call at gunpoint, and Walt calls Jesse and says, shoot Gale. right? To save my ass here, to back them into a corner. So, Mike, I don't know what he's thinking, I do know what he's thinking. He's giving this man the opportunity to save his wife. And he's showing a little bit of mercy.
You're right.
He's making the same damn mistake.
What if Werner had been like, Marguerite, they've got me. They've got guns on me. They're going to kill me.
Call all of your friends in Germany and let them know where we are.
Right now.
And then we're under duress.
You have 15 minutes to call everyone. Call the German consulate.
Right. Then what do they do?
Yeah, I mean,
what the fuck do they do?
I don't know. The writers slapped themselves in the face and said, why don't we think of that? I do think they are. I think they're trying, and we got feedback to this effect. I do think that they're trying to essentially draw a connection between Werner and Walt. Okay. And, you know, because obviously Werner is the first name of Heisenberg, the real life Heisenberg of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Huh. I didn't know that.
And, you know, I think that that's not a mistake that, like, here, Mike sees a fundamentally good person who, for understandable human weakness reasons, you know, colored outside the lines and got himself killed versus Walt. And he actually really liked Werner. Mm-hmm. In comparison to Mike, who sees Walt just like a bull in a fucking china shop and over petty, you know, ego-driven reasons and avoids death. Yeah. Like, it must be infuriating to have to kill a guy like Werner and then not be able to end a guy like Walt. And I think that there is some, like, smart commentary they're doing there. It's just, you know, I intellectually admire the symmetry that they're trying to draw here. At least I think they're trying to draw. But, like, the execution left a little bit to be desired for me.
Gotcha.
Because I'd just rather, like, it just been straight up, like, you know, Mike, like I said, I hate that we keep on writing fan fiction that sounds like it's better than what they actually happened. But, like, you know, if he had a daughter dying of cancer in Germany and it was clear that, like, he just wasn't going to make it home in time to see her, like, that's something that, like, doesn't make Werner stupid. It makes him desperate.
Yeah.
And, like, it allows him to pit his intellectual abilities against Mike. And Mike, like, you know, it's a sad thing he has to do, but he understands. And it's understandable all around. Where now it's just like, yeah, Werner's a goof. Werner's a goof. He needs to see his wifey.
I do think, I agree with you there. Like, it makes more sense if there are more stakes for Werner.
Mm-hmm.
But given what they did with Werner and his wife and desperately wanting to see her, I do think it makes him shouting at her to shut the fuck up and go home a little bit sadder.
Because we have
to understand how much he cares about her, right?
And to know that those are his final words.
Right.
So the
moment that they've constructed here is a nice one. I think it's just based on a foundation that is a little shaky.
But imagine, I just think that, like, still, you know, if this is in the context of Werner begging off to get to his daughter's bed, like, it would be even more brutal. Because, like, you know, you always think about, like, what if you die? What if you get in a car wreck and you had a fight with your wife in the morning? Like, mm-hmm. It's that, but, you know, like the increased stakes do nothing but help the situation. And right now the stakes were Werner missed his wife.
Yeah, that's very staky.
That's it. And not like, you know, like, he's an old, like, I, you know, like, I don't, I, fuck it. I, it's not like he was cut off from her. He wasn't on the far side of the moon with no communication.
Right.
Like, I don't know, like, current, you know, did Werner need to get his fuck on?
I can't.
He need to get his cuddle tank filled.
Uh-huh.
Like, what the fuck, man? Like, Jesus Christ, don't ever be a soldier and get deployed, you asshole. The more I'm talking about it, the more I kind of hate what they did. Because, I got more. So if you're excited to hear me bitch about the episode, stay tuned.
Jesus.
Oh, actually, we're here. Like, are we
do,
here
do you
for
have
the...
More? Wait, before we get to the next scene, I was going to say the final scene, but it's not. Mm-hmm. There's a Gale scene tucked
Werner's
in here
scene,
neatly.
Yeah.
So the moment where they take him out, like, Mike actually walks him out to the desert and shoots him.
Mm-hmm.
I think they needed to show that. Because if you don't show that bullet going through Werner's head, you wonder.
Fuck, man. Jesse shot Gale at the end of season three, and people try to treat
people
like a...
People still wonder,
people try to treat like a head cliffhanger. So absolutely, right. If you don't want people speculating whether someone's alive or not, you show the bullet and you show the guy dying.
Yeah.
But are we ready to talk about that scene? Do you want to introduce
it? No, we got to talk about Gale.
No. We haven't... I thought we... I thought we were at this, like, Gale comes after he gets shot.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to talk about this some more.
All right, this is all one scene of him begging and...
Because here's the other thing.
Yeah.
If Werner is the silly fucking fool that he is, I felt like he met his end way more nobly. Like, I think that, like, they're almost bringing Werner into a Gale kind of, like, aspect. And Gale begged for his life.
Mm-hmm.
And was very distraught and upset. And I just can't, like, I wish they'd played, like, almost Mike that he's embarrassed about it. Like, you know, like, there's this guy on his knees and he's begging for his life. Like, him doing this noble, like, oh, there's no way, I'm not talking myself out of it. Okay, I'm just going to walk over here and look at the stars. Mm-hmm. That didn't jive with the violent swing that they, you know, Stephen Root's character from Office Space wouldn't want to go off into the desert, and like he'd be a blubbering mess and he'd be begging and he'd be snot crying and all this other stuff. I didn't buy the intrinsic nobility of Werner, you know, letting Mike off the hook emotionally after all this other shit that had happened. Hmm. But I will say that the actual execution shot, that's one of the most beautiful shots and poetic and meaningful shots in all of Breaking Bad, and even better and Better Call Saul. And if they had done a better job of having this like a co-equal adversaries and Mike goes down respecting this guy to the end, that would have been like a really, really poignant and moving scene. As it is, it's just a pretty shot that ends a confusing and mess of an arc, I think.
It's a pretty chopped up shot too. Like apparently this shot, they didn't actually get this shot. Mm-hmm. They got like a much closer view of this shot of the two men. They took it into post and they said, we need this to be a much, much wider shot.
Oh, really?
And so they had, you know, a digital matte painting done by their effects team, and they shrunk down the main footage into a smaller window, smaller portion of the window.
And just built the
skyline,
the
stars. And then they built everything else around it,
Well, I mean, that's cool. I mean, I couldn't tell. I just thought it was going to be another one of those where the director just had the foresight to stage that, and they used the weird low-light cameras that just drinks in. And because I figured that's a tough shot, and it's neat because they got the glint of Mike's gun as it came out, the flash of the and Werner crippling. Like, that's... That's a great like Lawrence of Arabia type shot. Made it more moving and heroic, and it's just in the service of, you know, like I said, kind of a silly end of the plot.
All right, and then thankfully they cut out this scene of Gale, which was entirely unnecessary. You know, behind the scenes I watched it, and there was a scene. Maybe we can talk about the behind the scenes stuff where they cut out this scene of Gale showing the hole that Gus has been digging, and Gale is like super impressed with it and he can't wait to begin cooking, and Gus says no, the lab is not 100% ready, and then Mike comes in and says or conveys the information that the job is done to Gus.
I don't understand. I'm with you.
I'm glad
I don't...
they cut this scene because it didn't need to be in the extra long episode that we got.
Why the fuck is Gus like so against starting this until it's finished? Like, Gale's like, I can get a rudimentary cook. He's like, no, it's a...
Yeah, I feel like Gus is a perfectionist, you know?
But the thing is he's not... They established with a throwaway scene of Breaking Bad that's not true. Gale Better is the one that says, like, look, I can get you in the neighborhood, but if you want the... You want the primo shit, you got to get it from... Which was always kind of a weird plot point for Breaking Bad anyway, that, like, why does Gus... need it's the efficiency and all that, but like, does it really matter? And now they're kind of retconning to where it's like it's you know, Gus is the Mr. Hammond in the situation, spares no expense, and for his Jurassic Park. I didn't get it. And Giancarlo like icily saying, you know, it's not until it's ready, like that I don't know. I get it. He's angry and he's upset that there's the delay. But if that's the case, why the fuck do you have Gale down in this hole anyway?
Yeah, why bring him here?
Why did you take him from his studies if you weren't going to have him cook just to see, to have him bless the unfinished project? Like,
no, I actually don't like the scene very much at all.
Yeah.
And the fact that they left it in an episode that it was overly long and they were desperately cutting things to try and get it to time feels insane to me.
Yeah, I don't know what it's, I don't know the purpose that the scene is serving. Because it tells us things we already know. There's going to be a delay, that Gus is a perfectionist and wants it done just so. Like, it seems like it serves to, like, have Mike and Gus have a confrontation, but they don't really.
No.
So, whatever. I mean, glad Gale got another paycheck, but didn't need it. Felt superfluous.
All right, final scene. Jimmy's panel commences, and he begins reading Chuck's letter. Halfway through, he calls an audible, and he gives what the board and Kim believe to be a heartfelt speech about how much his brother meant to him. After the meeting, he reveals to a very shocked Kim that it was all an act, and he couldn't believe how well it worked on these suckers. He finds out the good news. His license has been reinstated, and he says he wants to practice under a new name, Saul Goodman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, he was in this zone. He was in this flow. He's compared it to improv and jazz. And like, Kim finally realized that I think he's evolved to the point that where even she can't tell whether he's bullshitting her or not. And that's going to be, and you know, at the beginning of the scene, like, it's poignant because Kim's like, hey, look, no matter what happens in there, I'm with you.
Yeah.
And then they book in it with the shot of her standing utterly alone, which is not the first time that's happened in this season. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, Kim's like, no matter what, like, what if you realize your boyfriend is a fucking sociopath?
Yeah.
Are you still with him then?
And you're unable to determine what is true and what isn't.
And the real thing is brutal is the way he describes the people that the mooks that he took in.
Yes.
Like, these suckers. That one asshole was in tears. Like,
and we see Kim in that scene holding back tears, wiping them away.
Yeah, very moved. So yeah, you know she's got to be applying this stuff right to her, herself. And I think your theory about her trying to emotionally scam Jimmy into, you know, shitting all these emotions out and getting off the emotional pot, I think was right on. And this is where she finds out that it didn't work.
And she had bought into the idea that it had worked,
yes,
too.
Yes.
Right? When he starts reading that letter and he stops and he gives this emotional thing, she thinks, I mean, it's not the self-serving thing where, like, my plan has worked. She thinks she's had a genuine breakthrough with Jimmy here.
Especially since, like, Jimmy did not lie. I don't think Jimmy lied about anything he said. He just lied about his emotional affect because, like, you know,
it's how you say
he is my brother and he loved me in his own way, like a brother. He didn't love me like a lawyer, but a big reason I did become a lawyer. These things are all literally true. Like the whole him going into the law library after Chuck's victory earlier this season in the flashback. Like, these things are things we all know. And he's him like, I'll never be as smart, respected, good as Chuck, but I can try. These are things also that I think were motivating him up until like this exact moment now. And it's tragic. It's tragic because you can see that even at this stage, there's a trajectory where he could still have a good life. He could, you know, he could be a lawyer. He could help Kim with the district attorney, the public defender stuff. He could get his own criminal law thing going. He could still do some cutting corners and shading, a coloring outside the lines, and he's a fucking lawyer, so he knows exactly what he can get away with, and he can defend himself, but he's just not going to get it. He's not going to get it because of this fatal flaw he has, which is seeing the world in terms of suckers and wise guys.
And a bit of a persecution complex as well.
But that's like, that's such a toxic way to see the world, is like, anyone that has, and you can start to see this creeping into your life, like, anytime someone professes to feel strongly about something in public, people like, oh, this is a performance. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, this is performative. This isn't genuine. This isn't anything from principles or like the idea that you might actually like, no, this is actually offensive to me as a person, or this makes me sad, or this makes me like it's all suspect in this garbage culture that we're creating. And it's It's a real shame because that's a hell of a way to live your life, thinking that everyone is as hollow and insincere as you yourself may be.
Yeah, and it's man, I have mixed feelings about giving this panel what they so obviously want. Mm-hmm. Like, they want him to talk about Chuck. And on mm-hmm. one hand, look, okay, Jimmy, just do it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is going to be the thing that you, the crow you got to eat, the shit you got to swallow in order to get back to where you want to be.
Right.
So just do it. On the other hand, fuck these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a very personal thing for him. Why should they have any insight into what he's thinking about Chuck?
Yeah.
None of that is their business. So I have very mixed feelings on it. And I don't think they could have played it better, in my opinion. He gives them what they want, but at the same time, he gives them nothing that they want, you know?
Right.
I think it's just an amazing scene. And Bob Odenkirk, like, if you didn't think he was a good actor before this, the way he switches on a dime from this heartfelt, passioned speech about how much he means to his brother, or meant to his brother,
mm-hmm.
to just completely emotionally distant from anything and everything, including his girlfriend.
To the point, I was afraid that, like, he's going on and on in his hallway right outside of here. Like, I thought that, like, right, when the panel's going to be like, those fucking assholes, I had them eating out of my crying eye, and, like,
right, jump out insincere.
That's right, insincere. Not emotionally, like...
Right.
I was actually worried that would happen, but it didn't.
No, it's a brilliant piece of acting.
And then also, like, it's a literal, I mean, not only is it the metaphoric emotional transformation in Saul Goodman, but they actually made it literal when he says, oh, and I, you know, I do think that was a little much when, like, he's talking to the person. It's like, hey, you know, it's like, we're ready for you now. It's like, oh, no, I know you've forgiven me because I was so fucking sincere. In fact, get me a DBA because I'm going to switch names and practice. Like,
this is not the same. This is not a woman who was in that panel, though.
No.
Crucially, this is the woman who's filing the paperwork.
But still.
She doesn't have context here.
I guess, yeah. And I guess
that's the reason for me that it slides. It
okay, because I wasn't sure if she was the court, like I wasn't sure if she was the court reporter or like who the hell.
I don't think she was in that room.
Okay,
if she was in that room, yeah. I mean, what the fuck?
It's still pretty,
there's no way, but
right. It's still pretty risky. I thought.
Well, I just love the moment of him deciding to practice under Saul Goodman.
Yeah.
Because in that panel, he had just said, I'm going to try and live up to the McGill name.
I know, like, I
and
know.
And Kim looks at him, and she's like, what the fuck, Jimmy?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's an amazing scene. And, I truly love this final scene.
It's all good, man.
Like I said, I don't think it retroactively makes me like the entire season as much as maybe the last season. But,
yeah.
You know, it was a hell of a thing.
Yeah.
At the end. That's it.
Before we get to feedback, I want to talk about the club.baldmove.com. You can go there and it helps support our podcast right off the bat, which is good because the podcast wouldn't be around if it wasn't supported. But you also can get a lot of cool bonus features like ad-free feeds and VIP access to forums, video versions of our podcast, extra bonus content like quips and Lunch with Jim and Aaron, spoiler-filled bald movie reviews. And such. And also, it's very convenient. You don't have to go out and wire money. You know, there's always cartel gangsters hanging out in the ceilings. They call them drop ceilings because you go into a Western Union, literally they drop on you and then they pistol whip you, review your security cam footage, and then you're dead. So we don't make you do that. You just go to club.baldmove.com. You swipe your credit card. You don't have to wire any trans. You don't have to deal with the deadly drop ceilings. You can just put in your credit card and make it happen. And the other cool thing is if you go to club.baldmove.com, you get to preview all those features. We got a little sample from each one and start a free 30-day trial. You can cancel at any time. No money has changed hands. What better deal can you get? No drop gangsters, 30-day risk-free trial, club.baldmove.com. Yeah, so let's get into feedback. Better cast all at baldmove.com. We're going to have a wrap-up podcast next week where you can rake me over to Coles for not liking the season if you'd like. But my thesis here is that this isn't a bad season. This is a very good season that is encased in 50% flab.
All
like,
right.
And then it's actually the flab to meat ratio is way like I've
this
I think,
is the bodybuilder who stopped bodybuilding and started eating.
Yeah.
And he's still got a shitload of muscle under all that.
He's still eating the whey powder and the protein powder. It's Mac. It's Mac. He's cultivated mass.
Right.
But he hasn't got to the current season where he's just ripped and shredded like wheat.
Yeah. He's done the bulk phase. He hasn't done the cutting.
Yeah, he just doubled down on bulking again. Because I've always said that, like, it felt like a lot of these seasons are like 2 or 3 episodes fat. I thought, like, the first 3 episodes and the last 2 episodes were the only vital episodes in his whole fucking season.
Hmm.
Which means
that's probably fair.
5 episodes of bulk.
You think so?
5 episodes of unrealized gains. I really do think that there's almost 4. And a lot. And the other thing is, I think that these last 2 episodes were super long, which, like, that tells me the season's just poorly paced. Like, if you got a flabby feeling season and the last 2-3 episodes are 90 minute affairs with commercials and everything, it's just you didn't do a good job breaking the story.
It's hard to argue.
And the thing that makes me nervous is that Vince Gilligan, I think this could be wrong. This could be unfair to Peter Gould. But I think it's as
call
a
me,
fan,
Pete. Call me.
As a fan, when I see the show struggle like they haven't struggled before, and I find out that Vince Gilligan, who has always been the paint us in the corner and come up with him, and you know, maybe he's the guy in the room that's like, hey, you know what, before we order Subway, let's fucking get this shit broken and, like, really sweat the details. Maybe he's that guy in the room and he's not in there anymore. And I'm not saying they don't have a good work yet, because this is still a great show. This isn't shit tier television. This isn't The Walking Dead. It's just disappointing from these people. The same way, like, if Romanov's coming up from Matthew Weiner isn't amazing, it'll be seen as a disappointment because he's the guy that made Mad Men.
Right.
And this is his follow up pit. Mm-hmm. So, like, always take this in the context of, I'm comparing this to a show that's in easily my top 5, if not top 3 shows of all time. So when they come back and they have these kind of, like, wheel spinning pacing, because, like, you can say a lot of things about Breaking Bad, but its pacing was never a problem for this.
She
for
was
them.
Pedal to the metal.
Like, anytime they took a break, it was just to...
I needed it.
It was,
I felt
just,
like,
it,
oh, thank
it was
God.
Just to set the table so they could make the next thing bigger and badder. So, like I said, it gives me no pleasure to say that I was bummed out by this season, but it's the unvarnished truth. So that's my opening statement for our wrap-up coverage we'll talk about next week to kind of set the expectations for feedback. Would you like to make?
No, I'm going to have to figure out where I stand on it over the course of next week, because I do agree that this was maybe the least entertaining season for me, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't want to go back and rose tint everything because of how much I like this finale.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really going to have to think about it.
Yeah. Also, I felt like it was maybe a mistake to not you get Galen there, but no Nacho.
Yeah, they talked about how they just didn't have time to get Nacho.
But that's...
You just didn't need Gale, though.
Yeah, like, again, like, you didn't do a great job of breaking the episodes then.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they also said, well, like, you know, last season with the finale, we didn't get Mike.
Right.
But, like, yeah, you also killed Chuck.
You had plenty.
And that also, anyway. So let's get the feedback. I need to stop.
We're going to do like an hour of this next week, so.
First up, Fred F. We talked about our discussion last week about how the sometimes the science details don't quite match up. He goes to the capers. He says, I seem to recall the Villa Gang saying they didn't want to get into the details or get the details right for some of their more violent science-like stunts.
Oh, right.
Because
or making meth, yeah.
Because they want to make it a fun story but not have any copycat crimes.
Mm-hmm. But this gum thing is going to happen, guaranteed.
Right, I mean...
You fucked up.
The stakes on that's pretty low, whereas, like, if you teach a person how to make fulminated mercury and they go blow up a bank branch, then maybe. But, I don't know, like... I don't think you're going to have jumping up the roof like Spider-Man copycat crimes, but I
good
get
luck.
That.
I'd like to see the copycat.
I get that, because, like, I think...
Into a drop ceiling.
On the one hand, I think that you can't hold a person responsible for, like, showing something and then someone goes crazy and does something that you inspired. But on the other hand, I'm the type of guy that probably would... That would bother me. That would haunt me if I wrote a piece of fiction that then played out in real life.
Yeah,
and possibly that so I get it. They're like, I I can say a lot of things about these guys, but I do think Peter and Vince are very nice guys, and they kind of stuff would weigh on their conscience. So I don't blame them. Can't wait till a wave of ceiling bandits sweep the country, though. Mm-hmm. Then what are you going to do, Vince and Peter? Eric H. I was kind of okay. So let's get right to the finale talk. It's kind of underwhelmed by the finale, especially in terms of plot. Nothing happened in a way that wasn't expected or pretty obvious, and Mike tracking down Werner had almost no energy to it, no zing. Could have been some real powerful and interesting moments or developments there, but no, it's pretty easy for him to find him. He barely puts up a fight, and then, okay, he gets shot. It felt very flat and not dynamic. I can't help but agree.
I guess I'll have to disagree. I thought it just clipped right along nicely. I'd never felt a moment where I was like, eh, this is going on too long, or why am I engaged with this?
It didn't feel very cat and mouse, and I was expecting more cat and mouse. Like, you can't...
Cat and mouse from Werner?
Yeah.
I don't think he'd be a very wily mouse.
Why? I mean, he completely circumvented the great Mike Ehrmantraut's security system and befuddled his goons.
Yeah, but he's...
Like, keep that energy going and make Mike break a sweat. I don't know. Like, the fact that he just... And that's the other thing is, like... So there wasn't a coded message. I think that Werner just planned his vacation right underneath the nose of Mike's guys, including wiring me money.
Uh-huh. Like, that was the talk of the vacation, I guess. Yeah.
These guys speak German, so how the hell did... I don't know. That's some unanswered questions there.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Eric continues, it's the same with Jimmy's final speech to the board. It felt perfunctory and adequate enough for the scene to work, but not nearly as moving as it was clearly intended to seem. As other similar scenes in this series has been.
I disagree on that. I was moved by that speech. I felt like a sucker like Kim at the end of it.
I also found Kim's reaction at the end to be yet another example of wondering what the heck was going on with her character. The whole episode is her being complicit with Jimmy using Chuck's death and acting aggrieved in order to help him get his law license back. But then she seems shocked that he acted and manipulated Chuck's death in that final scene. Okay, he fooled her in that moment, though it looked to me like she was playing along or pretending to wipe a tear at one point, but it's always the same goal of manipulation as an understood part of it. That's the one part I disagree. I never thought that Kim was being affected, and I gotta agree with my co-host. I was wrapped up. I thought that, in fact, I was almost kind of like, well, what the hell? They're gonna violently push Saul back to the Jimmy end of the spectrum?
Right.
For him to have this, like what the fuck? They're really going to put this off till next season? Because I do think if they hadn't successfully pulled that Saul Goodman transaction off, that'd be, like, bitch number one. We're like, really? We're going to go into the final season of Better Call Saul, and he's still not fucking Saul?
Mm-hmm.
So, Nick C. First off, Werner and Mike's final scene might have been the biggest gut punch since I watched Old Yeller when I was 5. But what really struck me was Werner's plea to Mike. If I can just talk to Gus, I can make him understand. This was the exact same speech that Walt gave to Mike at the end of season 3 before Box Cutter. Mm-hmm. Walt's begging made Mike furious, and now it makes more sense why. Werner was a genuinely good person who Mike admired, and Mike had to put a bullet in his head. Walt was a genuinely bad person, but Mike was constantly powerless to take him out.
Yeah, I like that. I like that callback.
Yeah, and I think that's where, like, that's one of the things you can point to say that, like, I think Better Call Saul will enhance the Breaking Bad experience, because you'll see, like, I think that Mike will be seen as, like, a pot constantly threatening to boil over.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since I think in the beginning, Mike does kind of admire Walt, and they were headed towards like a Werner, but like this subtle thing of like Werner in his core being a good person and Walt at his core being a rotten apple, I think is pretty smart. Good take, Nick. Barry C. I thought the most interesting thing about the finale was when Lalo got a breadcrumb of what Mike and Gus were doing at the super lab. That to me justified the whole German storyline, which otherwise didn't tell us anything new. Now the final season looks like it will be a classic Breaking Bad capering with Saul as Mike, Saul as Saul, Mike and Gus against a formidable enemy, and presumably the two storylines crossing significantly given what we know, given that we know that Saul knows Lalo. It really does look like the Better Call Saul we expected when the show was first announced. I do agree that, like, I really think that next season is going to be them just leaning into what they thought. Well, I think everybody thought Better Call Saul was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
going to be lots of Saul doing shady, funny stuff. He's going to. Do you have any like one thing I'd like to hear speculation on? Mm-hmm. Is how do we think that the Nacho and Saul storylines are going to converge? Because
that's a good question.
What kind of like what does Saul add to the table when it's coming to take out Lalo? You know.
I mean, the only conduit I can see is through Mike. That's the closest connection that Jimmy slash Saul has to Nacho at this point, right?
Do you think that somehow Saul will make it? Because like the one thing I can think Saul could give to Mike is the cleaner connection. But I think that seems like a Mike guy more than a Saul guy. And I thought that's the other thing. It's like I thought that they're going to spend some time this season explaining how Saul took over the fish guy, the fish veterinarian, as like the hub for, you know, the criminal connections in Albuquerque.
Right.
And they just like dropped that plot.
Yeah, they did. Like a cold, wet fish.
Yeah. Something they could have filled those five episodes of Flab with.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'll think about that some over the next week and do that in the wrap up.
Dan from Philly. Overall, good episode. I thought it was a good season with great moments, but nothing earth-shattering. Few points. One, everyone is saying how shocked and heartbroken Kim was at the reveal that Jimmy was being insincere in front of the board, but that didn't ring true for me. Wasn't the whole point of Griff that she's helping him to make it look like he did care about Chuck? I mean, she's in on the fake graveside display, the ruse of the library donation. She even reminds him it's not in the letter, but the way the words are read. So,
I feel like I'm delivering a bunch of dry pie here with my theories.
Right.
Like, I think theory, but my theory on this is that Kim's game plan was to make Jimmy also feel it.
Yeah, I think.
Like, put him through the motions, like you said, get him in situations where he has to think about this and get him to process it. And by the end, I think she thinks that she's done that. And so when he reveals that, oh, I didn't actually do any of the therapy stuff you wanted me to do, I'm an asshole.
Yeah. And I will say that I don't think you need to have that theory to believe it, too, because, like, it's possible that Kim was just on board with him fooling the board.
Huh? Yeah.
And then she just got caught up in the end and realized that when Jimmy's talking about marks and suckers, she's talking about people like her.
Yeah,
that
fair.
Still have a functional moral compass and a working non-sociopathic emotional core.
Right.
Which would be, like, I mean, I don't know how, like, that's why it's like, I've always wondered, like, what it's like to date an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, someone that can be violently angry or start sobbing on cue.
Yeah.
Like, how the hell do you ever have a fight or an argument or express sympathy? Like, what does it even mean when you've got, like, a changeling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of like Jimmy, only more evil. Like how do you sleep with a person like that? Because, like,
gotta ask him.
All it takes is for them to flip the switch that sees you instead of as a real person to a mark, and then they can literally justify doing anything to you. Even making you commit suicide by fire, apparently.
Right.
So, Dan from Philly continues, Werner. Smart man who does realize on some level the criminal element to his employer and his big plan was to take a vacation and to think they will be okay with it.
Yeah.
This to me felt silly and far too naive. Gus allowing Mike to live, as we know from Breaking Bad, seems a bit out of character. Mike screwed this up. Nacho's plot, arguably the most interesting plot point of the season, really didn't seem to get a fair amount of treatment the second half. They really dropped the ball there. I'm a little sympathetic to the whole shouldn't Mike have gotten a bullet too? Because Mike seemed.
Here's the thing, I almost think that Mike saves himself in the end, because he owns the responsibility for this problem and he takes care of it. And I think you could make an argument for Gus not needing Mike if Mike tries to, like, you know, make excuses for this guy and try to bring him back into the fold, even though he's fucked up twice now in the same way. Mm-hmm. I think Mike saying, I will take care of it, I will kill this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And fix the problem that I created or that I allowed to happen here is what gives me the leeway to say that Gus will keep him on.
Right. I broadly agree with that. The only thing I guess disagree is because they've made Gus out to be something of a sociopath. I feel like him, like what is Gus's underlying philosophy for his employees? Because, you know, Mike's got the thing of, like, there's good criminals and there's bad criminals, mm-hmm. and there's good cops and there's bad cops. And he's got this, like, very, like, Gus, if he's a sociopath, like, wouldn't he very much devalue letting a person's emotions get and personal relationships get in the way of mm-hmm. what you want to accomplish? And that's what Mike did. Like, he jeopardized it twice, like, by trusting Werner to not fly off the handle, and then by saying that, no, let me take this guy in. Like, as you said, you know, Werner could have really blown up the spot Walter White style mm-hmm. on that phone call. I like Gus, like, might be like, you know what? I thought Mike was my kind of criminal. And now that he's revealed himself to have this emotional vulnerability, I don't know. But that's not even mentioned or talked about.
Yeah, you're right. It's not. But I do think that's why I say he kind of saves himself.
Right.
By taking responsibility.
It's like, imagine if Gus revealed himself to be like Tuco, not just cold and calculating, but fucking crazy. Mm. Like, Mike would have some real soul search. Like, what do I do about the situation? But they never do. Like Mike's actions are kind of taken uncritically by Gus. And I don't know, maybe Gus is having a whole lot of soul searching with Victor. He's like, I don't know, Victor. I don't know this guy. You know what? I just sliced your neck with a box cutter if you ever got on a line, right? You understand? Oh, yeah, boss, I get it. Right. I don't know about this Mike guy. I don't think he gets that. Like, maybe that's happening off screen and they just didn't have enough room for it. Maria from Oop State, New York. So why do you think Jimmy was crying in his esteem? I think he finally came to terms that the law doesn't like people like him and that he will never fit in the ranks of HH&M. Maybe it's because he was finally grieving Chuck. I myself am not fully sure. I think it's somewhere in that neighborhood. Like, this is, you got to understand this in the context of him turning into Saul, right?
Yeah.
That turning into Saul requires two things. One, him to not to be a lawyer, and two, for him to be a lawyer that has no respect for the law, morality, or justice.
Yeah.
And
for that, I think it requires him to give up hope that he can be a better person.
And I think you're supposed to understand, and not only that, but you're also supposed to understand in the broad what happened before the reinstatement board fundamentally broke his idea that there would be fair play, because he did everything the rules told him to. Mm-hmm. The rules don't say you have to grieve your dead brother. And now he sees this thing as being like illegitimate.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, if it's going to be a performance, then fuck, I'll give you your fucking performance, but it's not going to make me a good, moral, righteous lawyer. So I don't know. I think the crying is it's hard to pin down to just one thing, because he's feeling a lot and he's going through a lot. Nicholas, after watching the Better Call Saul finale, I watched Breaking Bad season 4, episode 4, Bullet Points, and have 2 points relevant to Better Call Saul.
Is this going to be the notebook?
The notebook? No.
Gail's notebook?
When Skyler and Walt are preparing to fake the fake gambling story for Hank and Marie, Walter has a moment where he appears he's speaking honestly and then says, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I put you through all this. For a moment, Skyler looks stunned at his honesty before Walt says, how's that sound? And Skyler realizes he's just pretending for the story. Mm-hmm. This feels like some backwards foreshadowing to when Jimmy stuns Kim after revealing he was lying during the appeal to the bar panel. Did you see those suckers? Saul, now Jimmy is gone, stuns Kim, and her reaction mirrors Skyler. Yeah, I think that's a fair comparison. Skyler and Kim are both seemingly trapped by survival-driven, destructive partners, constantly being tricked by their duplicity, while always working tirelessly on their behalf, trying to save them and their relationship. Hopefully, Kim gets out before her life is destroyed like Skyler's at the end of Breaking Bad. Hashtag fuck Jimmy. Huh. Yeah.
Fuck Saul. Jimmy, I don't think Jimmy exists anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean,
like, I really do think this is the moment where you can put a pin in it and say this is the turning point from Jimmy to Saul.
Right.
Jimmy does not exist now.
Yeah, Jimmy's Anakin Skywalker. Now we got Darth Vader.
Right.
Tommy, I'm the rare Better Call Saul viewer who has never previously watched Breaking Bad. Wow. Get out. Wow. You're a fucking unicorn.
Yeah, look, I'm no sucker. You're not going to fool me with that.
You see tears in this asshole's eyes? Nah, huh? I decided to change that last week and have been binge-watching Breaking Bad. I just finished Season 3, Episode 10, Fly, and had to reach out to see if I'm fucking crazy. In Better Call Saul, the construction of the super lab was handled with meticulous precaution and security. The Germans are on 24/7 lockdown and surveillance. Gus and Mike are concerned with every detail and have zero tolerance for foolishness. In Breaking Bad, Walt is introduced to super lab, and almost immediately the unchecked shenanigans begin. Gus agrees to let a known junkie in and gives him his own key. No audio or video surveillance to catch Jesse skimming the overage. Walt going batshit crazy over the fly, breaking lights, and nearly dying from a fall. No concern over Walt and Jesse being followed to the factory, then disappearing beneath it. I could go on. I don't understand. It just seems bizarrely inconsistent with what we saw from Better Call Saul. Do you guys have any insight in this? I don't recall you discussing the differences in either podcast. Unfortunately, I think that this is another thing that doesn't... You're right, because, like, look at how much wired for sound and video Mike has this operation with the Germans. And it was a big plot point in Breaking Bad that Gus didn't have the cameras until Walt had done a bunch of inexcusable bullshit.
Right.
And then they put the cameras in.
And they make it a point to show that.
So, like, did Mike just get soft in the intervening years?
You know, it's really hard. It's a really hard thing they're trying to do. And I want to give them a little bit of leeway here and say that when they're trying to color within the lines of Breaking Bad,
mm-hmm.
sometimes they just stray outside of them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I feel about that. Like, it kind of sucks on one hand, but on the other hand, like, you know, they're only human.
Yeah.
They're going to write a show that is going to cast shadows on Breaking Bad.
Right.
No matter how you look at it, where it's going to raise a whole bunch of questions that I don't know that they can fully answer, with just this flashback sort of thing. So
right.
Yeah, maybe I think you're right. I think it is a weird thing and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but I don't know if I could do it any better.
I think that if they nailed the main points of the story, if everyone was like as breathless in this season as they were in season 4 of Breaking Bad, that you'd still probably have people pointing this out, but they'd be seen as rightfully mm-hmm. so nitpicks.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that these are starting to be like major what the fuck moments are a result of people on a fundamental level, like, you know, not buying the overall narrative, mm-hmm. you know. Or like in the case of like Neil, maybe they were buying the overall narrative, but then they go to Breaking Bad and like, well, wait a second, this doesn't jive with, you know, the stuff that I know about the universe to be true. So it is tough, but I think if they did a better, like, they could attack on either end. They could have sweated the historical details to make them fit more nice and neatly, which probably made the main narrative better. Or if the main narrative was better, we probably would overlook it because you're not going back to look for continuity errors and wild character swings if you just fundamentally buy it as it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unfortunate that you've got a little bit of both things not having great execution right now. Reginald has a screed against Mike. Mike should finally take responsibility for his actions instead of placing the blame for what he does onto someone else.
He did. He killed Werner.
He's tried this tactic once before, back in season 1 when episode 5-0, he tried to rationalize his criminal activity while the police force by saying that everyone in the precinct was dirty and you had to go along to get along. He admits to Stacy that he was guilty of stealing money that should have gone into evidence and that Maddie's partners were getting kickbacks from the gang to protect them. But what other heinous acts committed by his brothers in blue was Mike either a party to or ignored? Planning evidence, sexual assault, unjustified slayings? Whatever the case, Mike has options instead of going along. But Mike didn't do any of those things and instead blamed peer pressure for his misdeeds. Now with Werner, he has to deal with the execution... Oh, I'm sorry. Now with Winner, he has to deal with the execution of Werner. Mike doesn't want Werner killed. He makes several appeals to Gus on Werner's behalf. Mike even defies Gus to a certain extent by thwarting whatever nefarious plans Gus had in mind for his wife. But in the end, Mike still shoots Werner. It's not like Mike feels that Werner's running away has to derail the project. Mike even tells Gus that Werner can still complete the job. Mike is furious with Werner, but Mike didn't tell Werner, "I'm going to kill you just for making me look like a fool in front of everyone." Just like before, Mike shifts responsibility into someone else. He tells Werner, "It's never up to me." At this point, Mike has admitted to himself that something about the underworld is attractive to him. Instead of looking inward as to why he does what he does, he basically says, "I'm just following orders." Cold comfort to Werner's widow.
I think that's not giving Mike enough credit.
Okay.
I think Mike realizes that the mistakes and the trouble that has been caused are very much on his head, and he steps up and takes the responsibility and finishes off Werner. The ultimate decision certainly isn't up to him, but he could have stepped back and let Victor take care of it. He could have stepped back and let Tyrus take care of it.
I think you're right. I think he
realizes that he has fucked up here, mm-hmm. and that he needs to take responsibility and do this himself.
But I think what Reginald's saying is that when he says it's never up to me, that's bullshit, because Mike could have let Werner, if he doesn't agree with the decision, he can just let Werner go and then, you know, I don't know, start a life, go on the lam. It isn't like, you know, it's when he says it's never my call, that is passing the buck. That is passing the buck a little bit, I think. You know, like, you know, if Mike's saying that if it were up to him, is Mike saying that if it's up to him, he would let Werner go? I don't think that's true.
But he doesn't say that. He says it was never my call. He doesn't say he disagrees with the call.
Well, yeah. I mean, that does seem like a lot of double talk to me, though.
I don't know. I don't think you can say that Mike has the option to not carry out this execution and then decides to do it and say that Mike is still advocating his responsibility here.
Hmm.
Because he does take responsibility and he takes matters into his own hands and does the thing that and makes a decision.
Yeah.
Like you point out that he has an option, right? He can mm-hmm. run with Werner.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't choose that option.
Right.
He very much chooses. And, you know, he says like the decision is out of my hands, but it's not true because you just pointed out he could run with him.
Mm-hmm. Matt from Philly, I have a question for you about Jimmy's personal motivations after watching him talk to the girl who didn't win the HHM scholarship. Jimmy basically expresses this girl that people have already judged her and she never had a chance. And we understand this is how he really feels about himself, that because of who he is, he would never be accepted as a lawyer. Two seasons ago, we watched Jimmy get the job at Davis in Maine, where he was a real lawyer with a real respectable job, and he didn't want it, so he sabotaged himself. It feels like we have two opposite reasons for him becoming Saul, that he is forced there by Chuck and others who look down on him and pigeonholed him, but also because being a normal lawyer was seemingly boring for him. Do you think this tracks through the show and there's an explanation for his change, or did the writers flip-flop from Saul wanting to be sleazy? Or has Saul always wanted to be a con man and anything else is just an excuse to get there?
No, I think you're right. I think it's both. I think Chuck has been the primary driving force that he describes to this girl, you know, the mm-hmm. the person who sees him one way and will never let him be anything else.
I also have...
And then there's also the persecution complex where... Right. You know, he says, oh, they're keeping me down and they're never mm-hmm. letting me change. But he's doing all these fucked up things because he wants to cut corners and doesn't right. really want to be that kind of stand up person. So,
yeah, as I said, this corner cutting is like Jimmy's got this fatalistic viewpoint on things. But what I think is interesting is that like Jimmy's fundamentally a lazy person,
mm-hmm.
like the things that he has going for him, his superficial charm, his clownishness, those are things that were his natural blessings. He hasn't ever to work for him. It's always came, like Chuck said, it's always come easy for him.
Yeah. Whereas
and,
Chuck is like caustic and
yeah,
kind of an asshole.
But he's a hard worker and he's yeah. studious and he's
very good at what he does.
Yeah. And he's worked on, like, no one's born with a legal acumen. You
right.
know, you might be born with like a logical mind or like a believer in order and but you have to work on that the education and to become like a foremost mind in it just takes all that much more dedication. So I feel like one of the things we're supposed to understand about Jimmy is he's lazy. But he also doesn't want to be seen as the villain of his own story, so he always dresses that mm-hmm. up in some bullshit objection.
Yeah.
Like, that's where the I don't think the persecution concept is literally true, because season one and two prove that not to be true.
Yeah.
He was accepted by the legal community. He was seen, like, there's another universe where Jimmy just doesn't shit the bed with that Davis and Maine job. And he's seen as like the yin to yang to Chuck, and Chuck maybe grudgingly respects him. And like, mm-hmm. you know, but Jimmy doesn't want to work, doesn't want to do boring things.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to do the shit that Aaron was always up his ass to like do, like mm-hmm. dot the T's and cross the dot. Yeah. You don't dot T's. You dot I's and cross T's.
Well, he might dot some T's.
I've got yeah. a bit of Jimmy in me too. I'll fucking dot those T's and cross those I's. I don't give a fuck. that's why I'm a better podcaster than a lawyer. But I don't think you're missing anything except for, as is frequently the case, no one sees themselves as a villain in their own story. Mm-hmm. And everyone just wants to rationalize and minimize their own bullshit behavior because it's a lot easier to do that than it is to, you know, authentically change. John from Hyattsville, Maryland. This season of Saul had me prompted to do a rewatch of Breaking Bad, partly to refresh my memory of the connections between the two, but also to assess whether I think Saul could be the better show when it's all wrapped up. I still view Breaking Bad as one of the all-time greats, just slightly below Mad Men, which is, of course, half a rung below the greatest of all time, The Wire. You're a very astute gentleman.
Wrong, but astute.
The leftover should be in there, too, but, you know. And up to this season, I was certain that Saul could top it. One of the things that intrigued me most about Saul, even before it aired, was that they wouldn't be beholden to some of the modern TV's cheap techniques of pointing gun cliffhangers and threatening to kill the main characters. We knew definitively that Saul, Mike, and Gus would have to survive to Bad, so the Villa gang could instead focus on what made Breaking Bad good: cogent storytelling, rich character development, and its singular style of cinematography. But as I near the end of Bad again, I'm reminded the sheer force of its third-to-last episode, Ozymandias. Mm. Reflecting on the hour of TV tips my scale back to Breaking Bad winning the argument, because I find it difficult to imagine that Saul, or really almost any show, could produce a single episode so gripping, so unforgettable, and so undeniably the series' best. How many other shows exist that have an episode like Ozymandias? Curious to hear your thoughts on
this.
Man,
there is one, at least one, mm-hmm. but I'm going to say one. There's one more moment that this show is going to go for, mm-hmm. and it's going to be the splitting of Saul and Kim.
Right.
And if they can nail that moment, it's going to be fucking phenomenal.
Right.
Because that is what this series has been building to.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's.
I don't think it's going to be Ozymandias. I mean, Ozymandias is one of my all-time favorite episodes of television,
right?
Period.
Right.
It's if not number one, then it's number two. Only topped by maybe a Leftovers episode.
Yeah, I was thinking like when I hear Ozymandias, I immediately think of like International Assassin.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's been a few others here and there that are just like jaw droppingly great episodes. They're not coming to mind right now. Episode 4 of True Detective, the one with the like the 6-7 minute single shot take. Like
that's a spectacle for sure.
There's a couple episodes that certainly has left my jaw hanging on the floor and think that like this is something that I am privileged to see and it doesn't come around just every day. But
yeah, I think Better Call Saul has one of those up its sleeve. Hmm. They need to nail it. You know, they need to nail it. And even then, like for me personally, people can argue about this till they're mm-hmm. blue in the face. Mm-hmm. It's not going to change my opinion on it. Breaking Bad up till now has been a better show.
Yeah.
And I won't even say a better show. It's been a more entertaining show, and yes, it's been, for me personally, much better.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine for me whether the Better Call Saul can, at this point, I felt like at the end of last season, you know, I didn't think it could, but it wouldn't have surprised me if it approached Breaking Bad levels or got to that, like that same, like where you're like, oh man, you know, it's like, well, Breaking Bad had this, but you know, Better Call Saul had that. It's hard for me to feel like it's going to even come close to like dethroning Breaking Bad in my imagination.
It's a weird thing because Better Call Saul, I feel like it peaked. I think it still has another peak in there,
yeah,
with the Kim and Saul stuff. But I think it peaked with Chuck, right?
Yep.
Like, Chuck burns himself. You can't, like, where are you going to go from there, right? You've just killed your show, mm-hmm. you know? You've just killed the thing that made your show tick up until now. Mm-hmm. And they do that in Breaking Bad with Gus, but they mm-hmm. do it a season later. And you're like, where can this go from here? And somehow, in Breaking Bad, they managed to kick it into another gear with, you know, the chase.
Yeah.
Between Hank and
yeah, yeah.
Walt and, yeah. and the neo-Nazis. And, like, kinds of crazy shit happens in that final season. And it just goes to an even further level.
Right.
They're going to have to do that with Kim in this series. That's the only thing left. It's the only gas in the tank.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I'm tempted to say that they peaked with villains with Gus, but... Mm-hmm.
I think Hank, as an antagonist,
that's what I was about to say, that like
is the most fruitful.
Because what happened in season 5 is, you know, after Walt says, I won, mm-hmm. He becomes a villain and Hank becomes the hero.
Yeah.
And that's actually a really interesting flip. So, like, you know, it's tempting to say, well, the neo-Nazis aren't as compelling as Gus. Well, no shit, because neo-Nazis were just a whatever compared to the real showdown, which was with Hank. So, yeah, I don't think it's ever going to be able to get better than that. But we'll see. We'll see. That's I would hope that the Gooligans would take that as a challenge, not as an indictment.
Yeah.
Doug L. was the last, probably last Legal Corner. Maybe there'll be another one of the season. Last week you asked what role Kim could play as the brains behind the Saul law firm. So long as she had a license to practice law, she could provide legal support, but she lost that license, she could not. So
dry pie, man. I don't think it's going to happen. I can't see Kim being on board with the guy that Jimmy is now.
Look,
Saul
man,
Goodman.
I saw Jimmy drive out that esteem to smoke on the water in season one, thinking that Saul had arrived, and they essentially put the they rolled that boulder back down the hill for two more seasons.
But he didn't change the legal name of his law firm.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, like, so there's two ways to look at this thing at the end. Mm-hmm. Either we've already seen the Kim and Jimmy split. Jimmy just doesn't know it yet. Or, like, I think it's possible that Kim, you know, because she just walked in, like she walked in that saying, no matter what happens, I'm with you. Like, I think Kim's the type of person that, like, I think she, now we're going to see, like a Hank Walt or a Hank Schuyler relationship where, like, she's trying, she's a little bit more adversary, she's a little bit less trusting, she's trying to, but, like, I don't think it's just going to go to shit at the start of next season. Like, we're not going to get a cold open and they're just, Jimmy's moving out.
No, I agree.
So there's still, I think, there's still some room for her to, now it would have to be a much more cynical turn for her character.
Absolutely. And I just, that's where I get hung up.
Well, but
I don't think that's Kim.
But you already thought that earlier this season and were wrong. So, like,
But was I wrong? I mean, I was wrong that she was willing to, like, push a little farther into this scamming thing than I thought. And I guess if you want to say she's willing to go all the way down that rabbit hole with Jimmy, maybe. But her reaction to Jimmy's scam here is very much one of, oh, this is too far, you know? Yeah. And I don't know, being the sucker should probably open her
that's
eyes.
That's the thing, the fact that she realizes she's the mark.
Yeah. And has been all along is the fucked up thing. Like, she's got to know that.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, that's a very tragic end game. Like him working behind the scenes for Saul was always tragedy, right? It's just a little bit more so now, because now she's getting
God,
into
it would be the worst.
She's getting into it with her eyes open. Like,
yeah,
it's not a boiling frog scenario. She saw his bullshit laid bare. But, you know, like you know, we had that one lady that sent an email saying that, like, she's been Kim. She's been the person that excuses a bad person's behavior. And you always think that, like, as you see the glimmers of what they could be, like, it'd almost be unrealistic if she just got, wide-eyed clarity, like, oh, okay, I see how it is, I'm out. Like, it might be a whole season of her trying to justify retroactively her continued support of Jimmy. I don't know. We'll see. That's a conversation for next week. Doug L. on advertising. As for advertising, the firm, law firms can call themselves whatever they want. Typically, they use the names of founding or current lead partners, but they can also have more corporate-sounding names, like, just to make something up, Pinnacle Legal Consultants. But yeah, I'd never hire Pinnacle Legal Consultants. Keller and Keller are bust. You know,
that's too stuffy for me. Yeah.
Yeah. PLC. I'm not feeling it. I want a better call. I want a Saul Goodman. But for Jimmy himself practicing a Saul, that's a trickier question. I'm not aware of a rule against using a pseudonym, except that attorneys are required under the rules of ethics to represent themselves honestly. That could cause a problem in that Saul Goodman would not even exist in New Mexico's bar records. On legal documents field at the court, he'd have his bar number listed, and a search would still show James McGill. If I had to guess, perhaps Saul would have to disclose his real name to his clients or potential clients, because they would have a right to know who they're dealing with and be able to confirm that Jimmy and Saul is, in fact, an attorney in good standing with a valid practice to license law, or valid license to practice law. I will say that the one time we've seen him take on a new client, he was upfront with that from the jump.
He was. He did not make, too much of a deal about him right. using a fake name. He was just yeah. like, yeah, my real name's something else, whatever.
And, like, it seems weird, but, like, think about it. When I was like, let's say the you always use Killer and Keller because they're my whipping boy. Mm. They're the ones that advertise incessantly and seem like they skirt the advertising laws. I walk into Keller and Keller, I don't be like, I want to talk to Keller. I talk to whatever fucking associate, junior ass associate that they give
Not
me.
Not me. I walk in, I want to talk to fucking Keller.
Well, good luck with that.
You cart out one of those Kellers so like, right here, right now.
Yeah, why can't Saul Goodman just be the name of the law firm, and then as long as he says, you know, I'm actually James McGill, this is just a marketing thing. Right. And
yeah.
it's kind of, it's also an early confidence game, because I think the effect of that is number one, it's going to, anyone is like a legit one needs a legit lawyer will be skeeved out.
Mm-hmm.
But someone who wants an illegitimate lawyer, like you're, he's bringing you inside the joke.
Okay.
Like, hey, yeah. I can tell you're a smart cookie. So I'm not going to like, this is just something I do for the schmucks and the marks and the assholes. Right. But not you.
Yeah.
You're too smart for that stuff. So I feel like it's very on brand and that feels like something he could get away with if I'm parsing with Doug's here saying. Says you are correct that attorneys are limited in how far or as far as how they can advertise themselves. The primary restriction is that you cannot promise results because that's not under your control. You can't promise to win cases any more than a sports team can guarantee a win. Such promises lead to false expectations by the client and worse, malpractice suits when things don't materialize. When you advertise, what you advertise is skill, determination, etc., so they can say, I will get you the best result possible, or I'll fight for you. You can also highlight past victories as a way of bolstering these claims. I don't understand how Keller and Keller can have scary black and white footage of an insurance company hearing Keller and Keller and be like, we've got to settle this one.
Right.
Like, okay, that's not promising results in the strictest...
It's maybe inferring,
then. That's a lawyer's idea of not promising results.
Right.
I'll dramatize the
letter
results
the
promised, but, you know, I'd still think it's
can
like,
you advertise sleaze? Because if you can do that, I think Jimmy's got this nailed.
Yeah, this doofus that's got the box, the wears the boxing robe and
yeah,
the boxing gloves
the
and dial four for more.
4444444
Yeah, and like, more what? You're promising that you're going to do better, like,
which
again,
I thought that number was for Noble Romans, but I don't know.
I said
a lawyer,
there's
a pizza.
There's a guy in Vegas that's got the 444444 too. I just saw not okay. not Keller and Keller and not the guy in the boxing room.
Are they upset that now you have to dial area codes?
Do you have to?
I think you have to dial area codes. Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Which
that's,
really ruins that 444.
Yeah,
for the all fours.
Yeah, you got to remember the 513 or
right.
the whatever. In Las,
and you get the
Las
wrong
Vegas
one,
is.
You end up with a pizza.
Yeah,
instead of a lawyer.
You don't
if you've
want
wasted
that.
Your one phone call, now you're in jail for the rest of your life.
Yeah. So he concludes with a very smart summary. So there's also rules against the way clients are solicited, but let's be honest, now that Jimmy is Saul, the rules don't matter much anymore. So,
I mean, they got to matter a little, right?
They matter.
He'll get his license revoked if he doesn't follow them at least.
Right.
Plausible deniability.
But if Keller and Keller can literally show an insurance company shitting yeah. their pants at the mere mention of their firm, mm-hmm. I think Jimmy can get away, or Saul can get away with a lot.
Yeah.
And that's where we're leaving you this week. BetterCastSaul@baldmove.com. We'll be back next week with a wrap-up podcast. It's going to be like, you know, Jim and I are going to come with some more additional thoughts. Maybe we can think about where season 5 might go and the end game and how they're going to reconcile the gene stuff. If you got some thoughts on that, send it in to bettercastsaul@baldmove.com, and we'll see you next week.